From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, big data lets companies know what you've done and where you've been, and it could tell them what you're doing next.
Agriculture, industry, human relations, sports, I mean, name an industry, the data are coming.
How one college was decades ahead of others with its sexual consent policy.
We were accused of legislating sex. We were ridiculed pretty heavily.
And two banjo gods make an album and a baby.
He's learning how to eat and walk, and next he will be the banjo king. No pressure.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. Afghanistan finally has a new president after months of political instability. Ashraf Ghani was sworn in on Monday, and on Tuesday he signed a bilateral security agreement with the United States. That will allow nearly 10,000 U.S. troops to remain in the country past the end of this year to support the Afghan army in the continuing fight against the Taliban. Meanwhile, across the border, the Pakistani army continues what's been called a major offensive against the Pakistani Taliban that began over this summer. Christine Fair teaches at Georgetown University. She believes the U.S. and Pakistan face a conflict of interest when it comes to fighting the Taliban on both sides of the border. And Fair is skeptical of taking the Pakistani army's war with the Taliban at face value.
So I don't like to call it a war on the Pakistani Taliban, because that's not really what it is. What the army is trying to do, and you can sort of see immediately the conflict of interest for the United States, is that they're basically trying to take elements of the Pakistan Taliban organization and split them into those militants that can be persuaded to go to Afghanistan, where they are intended to kill us and our allies, and those elements of the Pakistani Taliban that want to continue fighting the Pakistanis. And the reason for that is the United States has a supreme interest in Pakistani stability. The Pakistanis are very good at exploiting this idea of the Islamist barbarians at the nuclear gate to coerce the United States to help Pakistan on its terms.
So then what does this mean for the fighting across the border in Afghanistan against the Taliban there?
The fighting in Afghanistan is going to continue. And Pakistan is really hoping for this, because as soon as there is no hope for the Afghan Taliban to regain power, all of these militant groups that Pakistan has dispatched to Afghanistan will have no reason to keep fighting.
So given all of that, what kind of an ally do you expect Pakistan to be as the U.S. draws down its troop levels in Afghanistan now through 2016?
Our interests are so deeply conflicted. The fact is that the Americans needed the Pakistanis because of the logistical requirements to continue funding the war in Afghanistan. And so from the beginning of this conflict, you had a supreme conflict of interest in the sense that the very organizations that we were trying to defeat in the country were, in fact, those very organizations that Pakistan viewed as its ally.
So is the Taliban the victor? Who wins in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, ultimately, the Pakistanis win. Let me caveat that. Even though the American troop presence is going to continue to withdraw, we still have this fundamental issue of whether or not the U.S. Congress, and ultimately it's going to be the Americans that continue footing the bill, not any of our other NATO ISAF partners. So the only thing that keeps the ultimate Pakistan/Taliban victory at bay is the American willingness to keep writing these bills. And I'm going to say it very bluntly, in perpetuity. Throughout this entire conflict, no one has even remotely considered a way of making Afghanistan economically sustainable. All we've done is focus upon troops, how many, where should they be, and what should they do. And this means that the American taxpayer is going to be paying. And until we stop paying, this whole thing begins to crumble.
Christine Fair is an assistant professor at Georgetown University and the author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. Big data knows you better than your own mother. It knows what you're going to do even before you do it. That's what predictive analytics is all about. It's the way all sorts of companies search through huge amounts of data and make predictions. So Amazon can figure out what you want to buy next. Netflix knows what you want to watch next. And Target could know if you're pregnant. In the world of venture capitalism, some investors have been using the technique to figure out which startups are likely to make it big. Now, one firm is taking it one step further, or actually backwards, using an algorithm to try to find promising entrepreneurs before they even start a company. Roy Bahat is the head of that venture capital firm, Bloomberg Beta. Bahat says the competition to buy up entrepreneurs is that intense.
There are so many companies being started and so many people trying to back those companies that if you don't start earlier, sometimes you feel like you're speaking to somebody after they're already well on their way.
So how did this idea come together?
You know, we'd seen some reports in the news about companies using data in new ways. Mm-hmm. And then we were sitting there talking to entrepreneurs and they'd come into our offices after they'd already done all this thinking about what they wanted to do. And we just thought, wouldn't it be better if we could see them 6 months earlier or a year earlier? And part of the problem is then they may not have themselves even known that they wanted to start a company. And so we started asking the question of, could we try to use data to predict who would start a company before they did?
So what data are you analyzing? What are the features that you're looking for?
We mostly look at their work history and their educational history, their public presence. And from that, you can deduce a lot. You know, for example, if somebody's ever worked at a startup that's backed by venture capitalists, then they're much more likely to start a startup in the future because that's the world they've seen.
And can you give me like a basic profile of this type?
Well, so you know what's interesting is we have in our minds this stereotype of what a typical entrepreneur looks like. Mm-hmm. And the reality is the people who start companies are incredibly varied. Roughly 40% of the people we identified were 40 years of age or older, All genders, all professional backgrounds. And so that's the amazing thing is when you use the data, some of your stereotypes just turn out to be wrong. And that's great because it means you're talking to people that the traditional system overlooks.
So you came up with a list of individuals. How many people did you end up with?
We came up with 350 people. They got this message from us saying, hey, we did this study. And based on, you know, public data about you, we've concluded that you are likely to be a founder of a startup in the future. And honestly, we had to email some people a few times because several people thought it was a scam.
It sounds a little bit like.
Yeah, I mean, somebody wrote us back and said, if this is a scam, it's the most elaborately well-organized one I've ever seen. You know, and all we were offering them was a chance to get to know one another and get to know us. And so we've hosted a series of events where we've talked to them about the process of starting a company. And our goal was just to get to know them.
We decided to reach out to one of those 350 targeted future founders that Roy Bahat and his team have gotten to know. The algorithm looked at candidates in New York and Silicon Valley. Emoju Miller is a PhD candidate at UC Berkeley.
I got an email, very random email from Bloomberg Beta.
She thought it was just another networking event, so she forwarded the email to some friends and invited them to go with her.
One of my friends emailed me back and said, I think you ought to read this email a little bit closer. Don't think it's a regular networking event.
Once she realized what they were after, she was intrigued.
And I did a cursory analysis of my own and realized that there's several things that I have in common with whoever potentially is the prototype of a startup founder.
Miller is getting a PhD in computer science and education. She has a job with Google's nonprofit wing advising startups. And, way to go, algorithm, she was planning to become an entrepreneur.
Probably within the next 36 months, I intend to start a startup of my own. It will be something in the ed tech space. I'm not quite sure the scale of the problem I want to solve. That's why I'm not rolling out and creating one now.
Emoju Miller says the outreach firm Bloomberg Beta didn't really influence her entrepreneurial goals, but it did one thing for her.
It just kind of validated me to know that I'm not crazy. It's like, okay, these are your people.
But the response from candidates that Bloomberg Beta found have been mixed, says the company's leader, Roy Bahat.
You know, as you might expect with any group, some people are completely disinterested and probably hit delete every time it hit their inbox. And other people are really honored that they were tapped on the shoulder this way. Some of the folks that we identified in our study already went and started companies. You know, one just got millions of dollars of venture funding. You know, my view is the real success is only going to be judged over a period of years as we see how these people's careers unfold and our relationships with them unfold.
Do you think this process in the venture capital world is going to become the norm?
There is no question. I mean, I am a believer that the things that we see in science fiction, you know, eventually come to pass. And if you've seen Minority Report, mm-hmm. where, you know, the precogs go grab the criminals before they even know they want to commit the crime, you know, that kind of a future is, for better and for worse, coming. And so I think that'll happen in agriculture, industry, human relations, sports. I mean, name an industry, the data are coming.
Roy Bahat leads the venture capital firm Bloomberg Beta. Roy, thanks for your time today.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for looking into this.
Over 5,000 Americans have died fighting in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. If that weren't heartbreaking enough, over the past 12 years, over 2,000 servicemen and women have committed suicide. One military family experienced both of those horrors. Before the tragedy, the Graham family would have fit right in a Norman Rockwell painting. Mark and Carol Graham were college sweethearts. Their three children, Jeff, Kevin, and Melanie, were inseparable. Mark was a decorated officer, and his sons were following his military path. Yochi Driessen's new book, The Invisible Front, Love and Loss in an Era of Endless War, tells the story of the Graham family and how, in a single year, they lost both of their sons.
Kevin had been battling depression most of his life. When he was in college, he was diagnosed formally and clinically and put on medication, and his mood stabilized. Kevin had been chosen for a particularly elite part of the ROTC program, so by all measures, he looked like he was doing perfectly. But then abruptly, he took himself off the medication. He worried that because of the stigma that exists in the military, that if they discovered he was taking medication, they'd boot him out. So he stopped taking it. And that was cataclysmic, because within a matter of weeks, his mood had gone back to the same dark place that it had been when he was younger. And on this one horrible night, he went to Melanie, his sister. They were at this point sharing the apartment, and said to her, "You have a lot of potential. You're this amazing person. Don't ever forget that you have this potential." She had no idea what he was talking about and went back to sleep. In the morning, he was supposed to have met Jeff, his older brother. He hadn't shown up, so Jeff got a bit worried. He called Melanie and asked her to check. She saw this closed door. His door was usually not closed. Opened it and had this absolutely horrific sight of seeing her brother hanging from a ceiling fan. And a year later, Jeff, who by this point was an army officer, was on a foot patrol on a bridge that he was leading his men across. He was at the very front, his men were behind him, spotted something attached to the bridge, something gleaming, and turned around to tell them to stay back. And as he did, it exploded. Had he not turned to warn his men, probably most, if not all, of the platoon would have been killed. So he died in this trademark way that you'd imagine a hero dying. And Kevin died very differently. And the way that the two boys' deaths were treated is what's haunted Mark and Carol for the rest of their lives.
You write about that, how the very different ways that military and just everybody treated the two deaths, the one suicide and one combat death. Can you talk about that and the effect that had?
So when Jeff was killed, he was one of the first people from Kentucky to die in battle. So the Kentucky state legislature had a resolution on the floor honoring him. Some of the flags were put down at half-mast. There were thousands of people who were lining the road on the way to the cemetery where he was buried in Kentucky. People would come up to Mark and Carol, talk about Jeff. Kevin had died a year earlier. People didn't mention Kevin. And when Kevin died, the question of how to bury him was very different. They were a very religious family. And members of the Graham family said, "Kevin killed himself. He died a sinner. So we should not bury him in a Christian cemetery. We should not give him a burial service in a church." Ultimately, the family had a fairly small service. It was in a funeral home as opposed to in a church. It was a lot of family, a good number of friends, but it was about 100 people, whereas for Jeff, it was well over 1,000.
It's such a heartbreaking story, but unlike most grieving parents who were in his position, Mark Graham was in a position to make some changes. Can you talk about the innovations he put into effect when he was the commander at Fort Carson to fight the stigma against suicide and depression?
So he arrives at a base that had this giant scandal of murders by soldiers, a horrific suicide rate, and tries to figure out, how can I make this better? And the things he did were revolutionary, which is kind of sad because they shouldn't have been. So, for instance, he would openly talk about PTSD, what it had done to his family, his own sadness. He would cry in front of other soldiers, which generals don't do. And for a lot of people at the base, first they were thinking, who's this softy, who's this weak man? And only later did they think that's actually a sign of tremendous strength. He set up a phone line, later replicated across the Army, where people could call any hour of the day and night. The phone would be answered by a sergeant he was very close to, and she would get the message to him. In one particular case, a mother called and said, "I can't reach my son. I'm worried he's going to kill himself." The sergeant who took the call called Mark at home. They immediately had the soldier taken out of his barracks, put him into therapy, and he survived. The other thing they did, and this was the biggest of the changes he made, and to my mind the most important, he created what was called an embedded behavioral health team. Basically, the idea was take a clinical health worker and have them be assigned to the same brigade all the time. So when this brigade deploys to Iraq or Afghanistan, this doctor goes with them. When this brigade comes home, this doctor goes with them. The idea was people will begin to trust this doctor. He won't be seen as this alien person where if you see them, you're going to be ostracized and seen as weak. This was someone who was part of the team. And this was something that began at Fort Carson. Mark was the first person sent off on it, and now it's used across the Army.
I'm speaking with journalist Yochi Driessen about his new book, The Invisible Front. What do you think, based on all of this, needs to be changed in order to get past this cultural barrier, it seems, to getting help in the military?
This is the definition of a hierarchy. This is the most obvious place where a person at the top can change things because everyone has to take orders from that person.
Mm-hmm.
But you can have people at the top talk about eliminating stigma, which they do, and they mean it. It's not just paying lip service. You could have people at the top saying, "We're putting more money at the issue, hundreds of millions of dollars," which they're also doing. But what you don't have are people at the top saying, "I, General Arun, I, General Yochi, I had PTSD. I was suicidal. I had these issues. I worked through them. It did not hurt my career. It did not hurt my marriage. My colleagues didn't think less of me. You can do it too." So when you're trying to change a culture, if the people at the top of the ladder, the people at the top of the hierarchy, won't talk, changing that culture will be very, very hard.
Have Carol and Mark Graham read the book?
They have. They were involved at every stage. At one point, they came and stayed in my house for a week. We just did round-the-clock interviews. They shared diaries and journals of extraordinarily intimate, painful things. But yes, they've read the book. Part of their reaction was a bit of nervousness about would people read it and think of them as having failed their sons in some way. But their reaction was ultimately, if a few people read this and it may change them, then they're willing to have that risk out there.
That's military journalist Yochi Driessen. His book, The Invisible Front, comes out on Tuesday. Yochi, thank you so much.
Thank you, Arun. I appreciate it.
Here's a story that's almost too perfect. The king of the banjo, a man who's expanded the range of the instrument from bluegrass through newgrass to funk and jazz and rock and classical, meets the queen of the banjo, a woman who's mastered and revitalized old-timey clawhammer-style playing and has fused her banjo playing with Chinese music. The king and queen fall in love, get married, and have a baby. Well, that's the real-life story of Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn. And even though they've been a couple for 10 years, this is the first album they've recorded together. Remember my long brown hair and the way I loved you everywhere. Oh, oh, me, oh my, where are you going without me? Abigail Washburn says she was apprehensive about recording with her husband back when they first started dating because she was still so new on the scene.
You know, Bela's got this really established, amazing career, 15 Grammys and counting, and, you know, I was a real newbie.
Yeah, Abby wanted to go out and make her own bones, you know, before we did something together so that people wouldn't say, oh, Bela's just playing with his girlfriend, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
She needed to have her own credibility and stuff, so she's really done that in the last year. She's gone out there and worked the roads, had bands together, done a TED Talk, did a commencement speech. And she's a known quantity out there in a much bigger way. So now it's when people hear, oh, they're playing together, that don't know we're married necessarily, they go, oh, I'm curious what that would be like.
You have a son now, Juno. What was, I know having a newborn is intense, so it's kind of amazing that you have this album while you had a newborn in the house. Because you have a studio
Good
where you
point.
Live, right?
Yeah. The great thing for us is, you know, we could set up the mics, get everything going, and then extricate Abby from Juno and go downstairs and do some work.
Yeah. When you're nursing every 3 hours, it's really hard to, you know, get out. when you're nursing every 3 hours for 45 minutes. So we would, I would just sort of get done with the nursing and hand him over to Grandma and run downstairs and try to record for an hour. And I'll admit it was really hard because on top of the nursing all through the night and the sleep deprivation, I was cross-eyed a lot of the time. But we just took it in little bits as we could. And I'm pretty amazed also that we, within the year, made a record.
Two little birdies all in the nest. One little birdie's just a-taking his rest. Other little birdie jumps in the sky. Fly, little birdie, oh, fly, little birdie, why do you fly so soon?
I'm sure you guys saw this. There's a hilarious piece on the website, the Bluegrass Intelligencer.
Oh, yeah.
That it read, after lengthy negotiations between their two camps, banjoist Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn have agreed to marry one another, advancing their long campaign to unify the progressive and old-time banjo empires under a single sovereign ruler.
And Juno is here.
Yeah.
He's prepared to rule. He's prepared. We're teaching him how to rule.
He's learning how to eat and walk, and next he will be the banjo king. Yes. No pressure.
We're on tour with him. It's the first time we've had him on tour since he's walking, and we're on a tour bus, and he does not want to sit down, and so the bus is careening down the highway, and he's trying to walk all around the bus, and we're trying to block him so that if the bus hits the brakes, he'll hit one of us instead. And he just keeps trying to get us around us. And
you're suddenly aware of all the sharp edges on everything.
Yes!
And the buses are mostly soft. That's the good part about touring buses.
That's true.
They're made for drunken musicians to not hurt themselves.
And it's bye, bye, pretty baby, baby, bye, bye. Bye, bye, pretty baby, baby, bye, bye. Well, I'll probably never see you anymore. May God bless you everywhere you go. And it's bye, bye, pretty baby, baby, bye, bye.
I'm speaking with Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn about their new eponymous album. I've always wanted to use that word.
It's a fun word, isn't it? It's a fun word.
And that's what you do when nobody likes the titles you've come up with.
Do you have some rejected titles for this album?
Oh, we do. We do. We shouldn't tell you, though.
What got rejected?
Nobody liked them because they are all about banjos.
Yeah. Abby's brother is in marketing. He said, you can't use the word banjo on this album. You can't use it. And we're like,
But it's a banjo album.
What are you? He said, yeah, but there's too many people have too many, you know, preconceptions about the banjo. And I was like, oh.
So we dropped our ideas, which were banjo, banjo. Right? Doesn't that describe the record? Don't you love that name? Come on, Arun.
Banjo, banjo is great.
Then there was Banjo Love, which really revolted a lot of people. So we
there were literally some like gag noises that would come up when we mentioned that name. So.
Yeah. So that's why we named it after our name.
Well, let's talk about one song in particular. It's a song of Abby's. It's called Shotgun Blues. Tell us about the song, because it's a different kind of murder ballad.
If I had a shotgun.
It's a murder ballad where no one actually dies. It's my ballad of revenge. See, I love murder ballads, old Appalachian murder ballads and story songs, and I quickly came to notice, especially when I was in the band Uncle Earl, which is an all-female string band, we would listen to these murder ballads, and we'd note that it was always the woman who died. So I started thinking about this idea of, in a song, being able to go back and catch that nasty old man before he got to that woman.
If I had a shotgun, you'd fall down on your knees. I'd get you talking, and you'd start begging, please.
And intimidate him into being a better person.
He just gives him a good talking to.
He gives a real good talking to.
So give me a shotgun, and don't you run now, 'cause if you run now,
That's Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn. Their new album is called Banjo Love, and it comes out on Tuesday.
No.
That was a delayed reaction. That was what I wanted.
What?
Their new album is self-titled, and it comes out on Tuesday. Abby, thanks so much.
That was a dirty trick.
That was a dirty trick.
Some people aren't quite sure how to feel about Ben Affleck. Maybe you liked Argo, but really don't like the thought of him as Batman, a role he'll take on in 2016. In the new movie Gone Girl, you have to feel ambivalent about Affleck, because his character might be a murderer or just an innocent guy in a bad situation. Gone Girl is based on the novel about a woman's disappearance and the media circus that develops as suspicion falls on her husband.
You don't know if she has friends, you don't know what she does all day, and you don't know your wife's blood type.
Sure, y'all are married. I maybe it's typo.
Where are her folks? New York?
Yeah.
Can they get here in time for this press conference tomorrow?
Tomorrow? I have no idea. I haven't talked to them.
You haven't called your wife's parents
yet? I mean, you can't get a signal in this building. I've been in here talking to you.
Well, call them, please, Nick, now.
Ben Affleck joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. If my voice is a little raspy, I'm a little under the weather, but it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thanks for coming in, even feeling under the weather. I appreciate it.
Not at all. It's what happens when you promote one of these movies. You get tired of hearing yourself talk.
So in talking about Gone Girl, we're going to be kind of dancing around spoilers because this film is a mystery. But the first thing I was thinking is that's actually something we can talk about, because that's one of your challenges as an actor for the first part of this film. We're guessing whether or not you're guilty or innocent.
Yeah, performance-wise, it wasn't something that I've had to do, I don't think, ever as an actor. I haven't done many movies where there was a sort of thriller component like this, at least in terms of my character, a mystery component almost. I'm really quite proud of the movie. I think if you like the book, you'll like the movie. And I think the sort of surprises and the freshness of the plot will keep people on their toes, as well as the thematic stuff.
It's definitely not a formula film. Once your way's in, you kind of have no idea where this thing is going to go.
Yeah, and the really liberating thing was not – usually you, when you play a protagonist and you're a lead in a movie, there are sort of some unspoken rules. You know, you have to be a good person. You have to be a leader. You have to be smarter than everyone in the room. You have to kind of, you know, always give people steely glares and that kind of thing. And in this case, we weren't encumbered by that at all. The whole idea of likability was sort of thrown out the window. And I thought that was really exciting and liberating as an actor, because you didn't know where this guy was going to go.
As you all know, my wife, Amy Elliott Dunn, disappeared 3 days ago. I had nothing to do with the disappearance of my wife. I have nothing to hide.
The hallmark of a sociopath is a lack of empathy.
What happens is the two characters, Nick, his wife is missing, and it ends up turning into a media circus.
Well, because we've created in the media, which is the kind of tragedy, vampire, 24-hour news, murder of the week media. Look, I've watched those shows myself. I wanted to know what happened with Casey Anthony and so on. But what happens is it gets exploited by people. The Nancy Graces of the world, you know, churn the story.
There's a great Nancy Grace type character in this movie.
You have the media that demands that we stay between the lines, that we play the roles right. If you're the grieving husband, you have to act and look like the grieving husband, almost as if it's a soap opera. And if you don't do that, you don't play your role right, then all of a sudden you're the suspect husband.
After making your own films, you know, directing so successfully, is it difficult now for you just to sit back and be an actor and
Well, when you're working with a director you really trust, who you really admire, it's actually quite relaxing.
And I guess with a director like Fincher, you know you're going to be doing something interesting.
Yeah, David is the sort of prime example of that, because he really is a master. I mean, Social Network and Seven, and, you know, he's made movies that I think are really modern masterpieces. Not only was it a chance to not only did I trust David, but it was a chance for me to learn from him as a director and to steal some tools from his box.
Ben, I got to ask you at least one question about Batman.
Sure.
I'm wondering if you have any trepidation about it, any worries about doing a superhero. I know you've expressed regrets about Daredevil.
Indeed, I have regrets about Daredevil. I have regrets about all the movies that I don't think were executed properly. One of the things I think, look, I'd be, if I thought we were remaking Daredevil, I'd be, you know, out there, picketing myself. But I think the, and that goes for other movies as well that I haven't been happy with. You know, I'm hard on myself and I have exacting standards and I want to do excellent work and I don't always succeed, but that I think you have to start out with that drive. This was written by Chris Terrio, who wrote Argo, who's not a comic guy, and it's directed by Zack Snyder, who's an incredibly magical sort of visual stylist who's steeped in the comic world, and you have this sandwich of talents. I felt very confident about it. You know, it's all material and director, really, and I thought, as you mentioned, Daredevil, I thought, it'd be nice to make one of these movies really, really good.
Finally, I wanted to ask you, I know that not everything on the internet is true, but is
you've discovered that.
Yeah, a couple of times. Is it true that you got your start as a young man in public broadcasting?
Indeed it is. That's when I was at, I started at 7 years old working at on a television show called Voyage of the Mimi, which is an educational show about math and science. It was part documentary and part drama, and it was produced at WGBH in Boston. And I did it when I was 7, then 9, then 10, then hosting the documentaries.
I'm Ben Affleck, and I'm in the Arctic Test Chamber for the United States Army Research Institute.
It gave me my start, and to this day, people come up to me and go, you know, I had to watch Voyage of the Mimi in sixth grade. I'm not sure they're grateful, exactly, but it is how I got going.
Well, as we know, all the greats got their start in public broadcasting.
Indeed, indeed.
Ben Affleck's new movie is Gone Girl. It's out now. Ben Affleck, thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
California just became the first state to pass a law mandating that colleges require their students obtain affirmative, conscious, and voluntary sexual consent. You might remember 20 years ago, Antioch College became a national laughingstock for enacting a similar policy, even getting lampooned on Saturday Night Live.
May I kiss you on the mouth?
Yes, I would like you to kiss me on the mouth.
May I elevate the level of sexual intimacy by feeling your buttocks?
Yes, you have my permission.
Christine Herman is an Antioch College alumna who helped draft that sexual consent policy after two rapes occurred on the tiny campus within a single year. I asked her to lay out exactly what the Antioch community put on the books.
You know, it listed the idea that you have to get verbal and willing agreement to engaging in any sexual contact. This was a huge fundamental shift in defining what consent means. And always the conversation around consent has focused on, does someone say no? And so at Antioch, we really focused on defining consent in a very different way and asking a very different question, which is, did somebody say yes? And so that is one of the things I really love about what we created at Antioch around talking about affirmative consent and what we're now seeing happen in California.
What was the reaction to the policy on campus among students at the time?
You know, it really opened the door for us to have just extensive and difficult, complex conversations around issues that many of us, I think, haven't had to talk about before in an almost a laboratory environment, frankly, which was safe to talk about, but also very active and very political. And it really, at least for me personally, became part of who I am. You know, that little bit of history was something that I think I'm very proud to have been a part of. And I think it was forging new ground, but I also think it was incredibly important ground and something that was very, very much needed. And so it was an exciting time, frankly, to be part of it.
Outside of the campus, I remember at the time, the Antioch rules, as they were known, were the butt of endless jokes, kind of held up as the apotheosis of political correctness.
Absolutely. We were accused of legislating sex. We were ridiculed pretty heavily. And of course, what's interesting is that media attention didn't even really explode until 1993, which of course was already 2 years into us living with the policy, where it wasn't that controversial because there were already two incoming classes of students who sort of thought this was normal and status quo. And so we did get very harsh and sort of mocking, disturbing coverage around the policy as something that was sort of crazy.
Do we have a sense, though, if things are are better at Antioch? And, you know, are there lower rates of sexual violence or any way that we could measure it?
I don't know what the data would be around if the numbers have gone down or not. But what I do think is definitely true is that if there have been allegations of any kind of misconduct, there are absolute wonderful steps on how to address those allegations and what questions to ask and what protections and what issues of confidentiality need to be respected, what boards you can go to, what the appeal process is, and also what supports are in place for both parties. So I think what we do know is we have something now there and have had it for 2 decades that really provides a safety net for students where they know exactly what's going to happen and that they're going to be protected.
How similar is this new California law to the Antioch policy adopted in the 90s?
So much of the policy is very similar to the Antioch policy and what it provides and protection and requires around affirmative consent, except it doesn't seem to have, from what I understand, the verbal component that's really key and that I think is what Antioch got mocked for, frankly, quite often, you know, in the Saturday Night Live skit and sort of the idea that you have to verbalize consent at each step of a sexual encounter.
Christine Herman is an Antioch alumna and a lawyer and social worker based in Brooklyn. Christine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Everyone loves dolphins. They're adorable, playful, and super intelligent.
The dolphins have learned a simple sign language.
These so-called big brain mammals.
Their intelligence actually rivals ours.
As far as I know, other than humans, dolphins are the only ones that do this.
But recently, some researchers have been saying, hang on a minute. Dolphins may not be as special as you think. In a recent piece for the magazine New Scientist, Caroline Williams rounds up some of the dissenting opinions.
A researcher called Paul Manger came along and said, okay, well, all these great things that they can do, if you compare them to other mammals, they start looking less special and saying that we really just love them too much.
So I asked her to qualify some of the ideas we have about dolphin brilliance. What about the idea that they can understand symbols the way humans can?
Well, the studies show that they can. Paul Manger comes back and says, well, so can sea lions. And actually, the sea lions learn it quicker. But we're not looking at sea lions and going, wow, they're so intelligent, we love them, you know, we should go and commune with them.
Okay, well, what about the mirror test? Dolphins can recognize themselves, right? So they have a sense of self. Well, not so fast, say some scientists.
If you look at the data, they perform the same behavior when the mirror's there and when it's not.
But what about their huge brains?
Yeah, they do have big brains, but then again, the relationship between size and intelligence is kind of a tricky one anyway.
I asked Caroline Williams if, with all the focus on dolphins, could we be overlooking the intelligence of animals that are, well, less cute and smiley?
Yeah, I think so. I did speak to one researcher called Justin Gregg, who's just written a book called Are Dolphins Really Smart? And he reckons that a lot of it comes down to a man called John Lilly, who was a researcher back in the 60s. And he was the one that was responsible for this image as peaceful, loving geniuses and spiritual healers and all that kind of thing.
John Lilly thought dolphins were at least as intelligent as humans and spent years trying to figure out a way to communicate with the animals. His life and work were an inspiration for the 1973 science fiction film Day of the Dolphin. George C. Scott plays a version of Dr. Lilly, a researcher who actually teaches dolphins to speak English.
Where is the ball? What did we do with the ball? Did Fa stop B?
Okay, that's a little bit silly. But William says that despite the fact that the real Dr. John Lilly did outlandish things like dropping acid with his dolphins, his research got a lot of attention.
As a result of his early work, dolphins did start to get more attention, so more researchers started looking into their intelligence. And Justin Gregg said to me, well, maybe if similar things had been said about sea lions back then, maybe they'd have had just as much study. So that's been good and bad, really, because it means that we do understand dolphins quite well because there's been a lot of research done on them. But maybe that has elevated them above other species. It may be fairly, or it may turn out that they're on a par with lots of other species as well.
Science journalist Caroline Williams wrote the piece Behind the Smile, What Dolphins Really Think, in New Scientist magazine. It's been called the South American Braveheart, a film that opened in the U.S. this weekend about the life of Simón Bolívar, the military leader who helped free much of Latin America from the Spanish Empire. It's called Libertador, or The Liberator.
Este continente está esperando por un diluvio. Un diluvio que finalmente lo inunde de libertad.
The continent is waiting for a flood, he says, a flood that inundates it with liberty.
Y ese diluvio comienza hoy.
The flood starts today. That rousing music was written by a first-time film score composer, Gustavo Dudamel. The same Gustavo Dudamel you might have seen whipping around his wild shock of hair as the spirited conductor of the LA Philharmonic. I spoke with him while he was backstage, just after a rehearsal at the Hollywood Bowl. Gustavo Dudamel and the film's director, Alberto Arvelo, go way back to their days growing up in Venezuela. That's where they first developed an appreciation for El Libertador.
We study Bolívar in the school, you know. We read, you know, his letters, his most important speeches. And of course, in every main square in Venezuela, we have a Simón Bolívar statue that, of course, is around our life. But to understand from where he came, to arrive to the point to liberate all these countries in South America is so interesting. And I think that for me was, in a way, a discover with the movie. I learned a lot.
I read that originally you were a musical advisor to the film.
Exactly.
But you made the jump at some point to writing the score. How did that happen?
No, well, look, I have a very close relation with Alberto Arvelo, the director. He was part of El Sistema, you know, the musical program that we have in Venezuela.
That's the youth music program you're very
yes,
involved
yes,
with.
He was playing the cello. We create this kind of very special relation. We are like brothers. And, you know, he told me about the movie many years before, I think, almost 4 or 5 years before he started. And he told me, you will be my advisor, musical advisor. And I was giving him many examples. Then in a point, I played for Alberto some things, and he told me, I'm sorry, my friend, but you became the composer of this film. And I was like, no, but dear, I'm giving only examples to you. I'm not a composer, you know. I'm not used to it. And he told me, no, start to do, and blah, blah, blah. And well, here we are.
Let's talk about this music. I mean, I got to imagine it's a heavy weight on you to write music for a figure like that. What was the kind of feeling you're going for?
My approach was in a very simple way, really simple, something like, you know, more atmospheric. For example, in a battle scene, I didn't use an orchestra complete doing things. I used sometimes a children choir, you know, singing on the top of that, you know, of the action. So you have this kind of contrast.
I'm speaking with LA Philharmonic music director Gustavo Dudamel. He's composed the score for the new film Libertador, The Liberator. Bolivar's liberation movement was a kind of a transnational thing. People came from all over the world to fight alongside him. Is that spirit reflected in the music?
I think yes. It's very epic. I was very inspired in a way from Copland.
Aaron Copland.
Yeah, the fanfare for a common man, you know? Ta-da-da, ta-da-da. And for me, it was like kind of a key for me to describe the character of Bolívar. Bolívar was a common man that became a hero, became a liberator of many countries. And from that, for me, was like kind of, wow, this is the kind of things that I would love to get inspired from this motif to go and to create this. Thank you. And I was trying to use some ethnic elements. I have this wonderful friend, Pedro Stache, that he was playing all the ethnic flutes. That was a kind of element to pay homage to the people before the Spanish conquer, you know.
You know, I've got a feeling that now other film directors are going to be calling you up and saying, Gustavo, I've got this great film. Well, can you write something for me? What are you going to tell them?
Well, never say never. I don't know. If I have the right, let's say, the right conditions, in the sense of to have the time, because you need the quality of time to do the things. You cannot be, you know, crazy. And I think if I can have the quality of time to repeat the experience again, look, I will do, because I love it. And if this happens, I will be happy. And if not, also I will be happy.
That's Gustavo Dudamel. His day job is conducting the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Now he's also a film score composer. His first is for the movie The Liberator, which opened in the States this weekend. For the week ending October 5th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, Becky Sullivan, Denise Guerra, and Eliza Mills. Our intern is Chloe Persinos. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leo Delagila and Marcia Caldwell. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.